Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan have come to grief in their perilous round-the-world flight. Several hundred miles from Howland Island in the mid-Pacific, their great plane, fitted out as a flying laboratory, is down. Stranded on a coral reef, it's believed, from fragmentary and weak radio calls for help.
And that was July 1937, that one of the most well-known names in the history of aviation, Amelia Earhart. She set so many records. She was the first solo flight across the Atlantic by a woman. She wrote books. She set up an organization for female pilots. She sounds, to all intents and purposes, very, very cool. But off she went, and never has she been found. And the circumstances were dramatic and mysterious, and took the world by storm. Well, this month, Robert Ballard and a National Geographic expedition are embarking on a search for that plane. Apparently, it's in the Pacific somewhere, they reckon, near an atoll that forms something called the Phoenix Islands. Now, Robert Ballard, I don't know if you know that name. He's the dude who discovered the Titanic. So, you know, he's got a bit of form in this field. I actually don't know a lot about Amelia Earhart. I know that she's one of those incredible people that I should know about, and I thought, well, this is too good an opportunity to miss. My guest today has written a number of books, including Amelia Lost, The Life and Disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which has been used as a really big education resource in the United States. She joins me on the line from Chicago. Candace Fleming, how are you?
I'm terrific. How are you?
Are you horrified that I say, look, I feel like I don't know a lot about Amelia Earhart? Is that sacrilege to you?
I don't think so. I think what most people know is that she disappeared, and I don't think they actually know much about the actual woman. I know in the United States, that's what we know, that there's a mystery that she went missing, and we don't know quite where she, you know, we don't know at all where she disappeared. But I think that's what most people know about her.
Tell me about her.
She was extraordinary. She was a woman far ahead of her time for the 1920s and the 1930s. As a child, she was a real tomboy. She didn't want to follow all the rules that were prescribed by society for females at the turn of the 20th century. She, in fact, couldn't understand them, didn't understand why she couldn't do exactly what the boys wanted were able to do. Couldn't understand why she couldn't do things like join the basketball team or the Boy Scouts or ride on a sled on her belly instead of sitting all demure and ladylike on a
side saddle on the sled.
Yeah, the sitting sled. And so, you know, she was one of those kids that just kept pushing and pushing. Her grandmother, who she lived with, wanted her to be ladylike, but her parents actually went ahead and encouraged her to follow those interests that she had. In fact, her mother made her a pair of what she called bloomers pants
yes.
to play in, so that she wasn't, you know, all in a skirt and unable to climb and jump. And so this is a characteristic that carried all the way through her life. She becomes this woman in the public eye that Americans, and I say people around the world, looked at and said, here's a woman who's doing what she wants to do, doing anything she wants to do as a woman. And we've not really seen that before, especially in the public eye. And she was unbelievably popular and very much in the public eye.
How did she first get into the public eye?
She crossed the Atlantic in 1927, 2 years, almost to the day that Charles Lindbergh had done it. It was a bit of a stunt. They couldn't have the first man cross the Atlantic. Lindbergh had done it 2 years earlier. And so they decided to do this thing where they would have a woman, the stunt flight, the first woman to cross the Atlantic. She didn't fly, however. She sat in the back, and there was a male pilot and a male navigator. And she basically, they called her, they gave her the official title of captain of the expedition. But in fact, she sat in the back of the airplane, not particularly the most noble heroic thing, right?
Right?
She's just passenger, basically. But people really took her to heart in 1929. They really, even though it was two men that had flown the plane, and that's still a dangerous endeavor in 1929. It was Amelia Earhart that the public turned to, and so she was instantly famous in 29. Then she continued to do a lot of stunt.
That gave her the springboard, I guess, the profile
sure
to actually
and
be able to take this on herself.
Yeah, and in 1932, she decided that she would fly that Atlantic. She was going to solo because she always felt the first time was a bit of a cheat. So she went and did it in 32. It really does.
Oh, okay.
First woman to fly across the Atlantic herself alone.
Because the way you described her, I can imagine that must have really stuck in her craw that she was sat.
It is.
She was not a sit in the back of the plane sort of woman, from what you're telling me.
She is definitely not a sit in the back of the plane kind of woman. And I'm sure she was also a woman that seized chances. She saw opportunities. She was extraordinary in that way. And so she saw that this opportunity in 1929, which basically fell in her lap. She was actually working at a settlement house with recent immigrant children who'd come, and she was actually working at one of these in Boston. And the phone rang, literally, at this tenement house, this settlement house. And they asked if she was Amelia Earhart, and they had this offer for her because they had been searching this group of people, including George Putnam, who was a book publisher, later became her husband. They were searching for this perfect woman to take across to 1929, intelligent, educated, attractive. They thought it was a real plus that she looked a little bit like Charles Lindbergh, who was, of course, the most famous man of the world in 1929.
She looked
doing
a bit
the exact
like him.
Same thing. And they encouraged it. When they took publicity photos before she left, they put, it was the same exact poses that Lindbergh's famous flight pictures were, and they even put her in that leather helmet, the same helmet that
because
he wore.
Oh, that's so funny. If you're just joining us, I must say, if you are just joining us, you are in the middle of a ripping yarn, and we've got a long way to go. So settle in, because we are talking about the life and times of Amelia Earhart. My guest on the line from Chicago is Candice Fleming, who's written a lot of books, and she's a real authority. Probably the main one that's used as an education resource in the U.S. is Amelia Lost, The Life and Disappearance of Amelia Earhart.
Around the world, Ladybird and her crew, ready for an adventure that nobody has ever tried before. Amelia Earhart, out to circle the Earth at the latitude of the equator, and that's the.
And we're sharing a bit of who Amelia was, a bit of Candice's journey with her, and we're going to get on to the fact that there is a search about to take place. And so we're trying to get a sense of why this matters so much with Candice Fleming. So she's been through, I mean, these little quirks of fate fascinate me. There are so many moments that this could have derailed for her. Like, God bless her parents, you know, at a time when it would have been easier to give her a clip around the head and say, you know, go practice the walking with the book on your head. They gave her pants to play with, and she went out and she caused a ruckus, and she became the most famous woman in the world. And then the fact that she was selected to go on the trip because she looked a bit like the guy who did it.
Like Lindbergh, and they wanted, like I said, they wanted a woman. They wanted someone that was educated, attractive,
yeah,
and could fly. She really was able to fly by that.
And then
point.
She started taking this stuff on for herself. She did that first flight across the Atlantic, and I'll play you a bit of her in a little while talking about that flight. So we did, Candice kindly sent me a link where we can actually listen to Amelia Earhart, which I'm really excited about, and I'll play that for you in a second. But let's fast forward a second to, so she's gone across the Atlantic in 1932, but it was 1937 that she decided to fly around the equator. Was that the next big trip, or were there other big trips between 32 and 37?
She had done a few things. She had, entered a women's derby race, and she had broken some records for speed and for altitude. But she hadn't really done a big stunt in a while. She also knew that by 1937, people, especially in the United States, but I think around the world, they just really didn't, you know what, people could actually fly in an airplane themselves by 1937.
Yep.
So they weren't as fascinated by aviation as they had been 10 years ago when, you know, Charles Lindbergh first made that flight across the Atlantic, or even in 32 when Amelia went across the Atlantic. They were fascinated by her because she was the most famous of the female pilots. I wouldn't say she was the best, but she was certainly the most famous.
There were a few other female pilots.
There were several, yeah, people like Eleanor Smith, extraordinary pilots. But Amelia was well known in part because she married George Putnam, who published her first book, and was also extraordinarily good at publicity. So he suggested places that she should speak, suggested products that she should endorse on the radio, suggested lectures that, you know, she should give. And she was willing to do that. It wasn't like he forced, nobody forces Amelia to do anything, right? She certainly wanted to do that, and she certainly wanted his help. But by the time George Putnam enters her life, she really is on the fast track to big fame by this point. So in 37, she knows that this is probably her last big stunt. People are not really caring that much about stunt flights. And in fact, even though she's taken off in 1937, Americans weren't really paying attention. She was writing serial newspaper articles during the trip that she would send back, and they were being printed in the newspaper. In 32, Americans really hung on everything that she did on a round, you know, on a long distance flight. But by 37, it was sort of old hat for them until she disappeared, and then suddenly.
The scene
really
was set,
really
wasn't it? The times had changed. It was her last. How often do we hear that? This is my last one, my last big journey. Mm-hmm. The scene, you know, I need to grab people's attention again to help them understand why this matters.
Right.
And she goes off the radar.
Yeah. And that's, And so I think, you know, then of all the things, then she disappears in 37. And, wow, her name is sealed, I think, in history at that point.
Candice Fleming is my guest. She is the author of Amelia Lost, The Life and Disappearance of, and I think you're getting a strong sense of why, the wonderful Amelia Earhart.
Would you mind indicating on this blackboard exactly the trials and difficulties that you encountered in coming across?
Well, I'll try to give you some of the highlights of the trip if you wish. I took off the famous Harbor Grace runway at dusk, about 7:30, I believe. I flew for a couple of hours while sunset lasted, and then two more hours as the moon came up over a bank of clouds.
You're listening to It's Just Not Cricket, ABC Radio across Australia. This is Amelia Earhart describing her journey across the Atlantic.
One of the most severe I have ever been in. I milled around in the storm here for probably an hour and with difficulty kept my course. I had been troubled with my exhaust manifold burning through all night. A weld broke shortly after I left Harbor Grace.
Amelia Earhart, the voice that echoes through the ages for so many reasons. She disappeared in 1937. Her plane has never been found. We're going to find out very shortly whether they will find it. But Candice Fleming, you've written so much about her. You've been obviously fascinated by her. Why did she become such a huge part of your life?
You know, she was a huge part of my mother's life. I always tell this story. I know that the reason I'm fascinated and continue to be fascinated by her was when I was a kid, my mother used to tell this story about her childhood. And one of the stories, the most poignant stories that she told, was the day that she was listening to the radio. It was July 3rd of 1937. And she was listening to the radio. I think she was about 13 at the time. And the radio announcer broke in and said they had this breaking news. Amelia Earhart, they lost her, and they believed she'd gone down at sea. And my mother, who looked at Amelia Earhart as this woman that could do anything, that she really was a role model for my mother and millions of other women as well, and young women, she really was a role model of what possibilities for female possibilities beyond traditional role of wife and mother. So my mother could not believe that this would happen to this astonishing hero of hers, Amelia Earhart. And so she lived on in this town on Lake Michigan, and she went down to the beach, and she stood on this expanse of sand, and she looked up into this cloudless blue July sky, summer sky, And she stood there and she watched and she waited. And she really believed at the time that if she stood there long enough, she would see Amelia Earhart winging her way over the lake back to Purdue University, which is where Amelia was working at the time. And, of course, she never came. And my mother would tell this story, and she could still hear this heartbreak in her voice.
Really?
And so
how old was she?
She must have been 12 or 13. If I do the math, you know, she was 12.
And did she? Was it just the once that she went out to look into the sky?
She did, and she says that she stood there, and, you know, who knows what her memory is, but she swears that she stood and waited and waited.
And willed and wished for Amelia to come. That's such a beautiful story.
Did.
That gives such a strong sense, because it's so easy for us to say in 2019, oh, she had an impact on people. But then you think to that time and place, what a female role model like that must have meant to a young girl, so that she was so desperate to will her over the horizon home that she stood
and
watched.
She truly believed it. She just couldn't believe she wouldn't.
Oh,
you know,
that's
no
beautiful.
Way. Amelia Earhart was going down. So I always say, you know, Amelia Earhart broke my mother's heart, but she sort of broke my heart through my mother's memories. And so she's always been a name that if someone says Amelia Earhart all my life, you know, my ears perk up. So
Candace Fleming. Oh, well, it was, wasn't it? Like, you had no choice. Candace Fleming is my guest. Before we move on to Robert Ballard, in all your years of research of Amelia Earhart and taking your legacy of looking at her and being interested in her, what's the most surprising thing you learned about her?
You know, I think it was a lot of little things. I think the most surprising thing was that Amelia Earhart, she wasn't the most truthful person.
What do you mean?
Let me explain that, because it sounds terrible. But
it's very 2019, so don't worry.
When I was doing the research, I would come across these wonderful stories, stories that I'd heard frequently. For example, she would tell this story in her own biography for the fun of her autobiography. One of them is called For the Fun of It. She tells the story about how she was 11 years old and she first saw an airplane in 1908 at the Iowa State Fair, but that she was not the least bit interested in it because she had bought this little hat that had been made out of a peach basket and she'd paid a quarter for it. And she was just so enamored with this little girly thing that she didn't really notice that her future was right there in front of her. Now, this is a really great story, right? But when I actually delved beyond her own words, what I discovered, all it took was a little thinking about it, that in the scheme of aviation history, 1908 would have been, there could have been no demonstration flights in 1908. We're only talking 5 years earlier that the Wrights actually invent the airplane.
So it's a bit
just to
early.
Make sure I had my history right, I called the Iowa State Historical Society.
Yeah.
Who was at that fair that year? There's no airplane. And I'm like, well, heck, I can't tell this story. And it was so great, so I checked that one off. Then I find this great story about that wonderful tousled mop of hair that she always claimed was just natural, and she cut it off because she didn't care what she looked. I mean, this is part of her image, right?
Yeah.
She didn't care what it looked like at all. And then I discover that she actually took a curling iron to it to make it look tousled. And I was like, really? I have to take that off of my... And then I had this great story about Fred Noonan, her navigator, who went around the world with her, and she always said that he would navigate, tell her what direction to fly in, and that he would do this on a note that he passed to her on a fishing pole from the back of the Electra, the plane that she was flying around the world. And, of course, that was nonsense. Of course, he sat up in the cockpit. So there must have been 10, 12, 14 great stories that all of a sudden I'm ticking off. I can't tell that. And I remember, I got to one of them that I realized was not true, and I was so frustrated, and I came banging out of my office, startled my family, and I said, I am so frustrated. She is such a liar. You know, I'm going to call my I'm going to call this book Flyer, Flyer, Hands on Fire. And, but then I got to thinking about it. And I realized that all of those stories that she told about herself, all of that myth-making about herself, was really for a purpose. And it really told me so much more about her, because she needed to make money. She needed to be palatable to the American public, who in the 1930s still wanted their females, they didn't want them to be too out there, right?
Yeah.
So she had these sweet little stories she told about herself. Kept her a little more feminine, kept her palatable to the public, so the public loved her, and they continued to buy her books, and they went to her lectures.
And she could inspire.
Make money.
And she could inspire.
All she wanted was to make money, and what did she want the money for? To fly. It's all she wanted to do. So everything was just a single purpose, to get back up in the sky, you know.
You're listening to It's Just Not Cricket, ABC Radio across Australia. Candice Fleming is my guest. I have had such a good time talking about who Amelia was and why Candice loves her, so that we are completely running out of time to talk about The Search. So we'll do this quickly. But I've just loved hearing about her a bit more, and about your, because this is a show about people, and you're just so fascinating, and I love the journey. But Robert Ballard, the guy who found the Titanic, this month is going to go find Amelia Earhart. How do we feel about that? Will he succeed?
Well, I believe he will. I spent some time with him. He tells me, yes, that he will. He told me he figures 3 days.
Really?
Once he gets out there, he figures 3 days.
But do we know, because I mentioned the atoll, right, near the Pacific, the Phoenix Islands in the Pacific. But do we actually know?
Well, there's Rick Gillespie, who's part of Tiger, which is this aviation research, historical research, has been doing for 20 years research about where he believes she actually went down at. And he has a mountain of pretty good evidence that has sort of convinced me that she did indeed land on this island. It was old Gardner Island, which is now Nicomoro, is that right? So they believe that's actually where she landed, but it was on an atoll that as the tide came in and the tide went out, it kept moving that plane till eventually, it was knocked off into the deep ocean.
Right.
And then Amelia and Fred probably perished on that island. So
there's a chance they could have survived the crash.
They believe so. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that Rick Gillespie and his group has gathered. That's also included in my book. That's people that heard her, because they were using those wonderful wireless, shortwave radios back in the 1930s.
Oh.
And so people were listening, not just to listen to radio stations, but they could get radio frequencies at certain times of the day. If they had good radios, they could hear, far, far away. And so we have really good accounts of people, not cranks, but people that were believed at the time that heard her in places like Wyoming and Florida and Hawaii and across the Pacific. And they've done some computerized, which sort of convinced me, they did a computer program that ran on the frequency with the same weather, same time of day, and they did a little computer program to see if it was possible that those folks did hear her, and they did. So they heard her for days. On and off, until they didn't. And they only heard her at certain times, which corresponds with the tides going in and out. So there's a lot of evidence.
So when are they setting off? When's Robert heading out there?
Oh, I think it's the 5th of August. So
hang
is
on.
That today? He's
Wait,
off.
What? No, he's gone. He's...
or was that yesterday?
No, that was earlier this week. That was Monday.
Yeah.
That was Monday. Oh, look at us. We haven't.
So he's off.
So we might hear. We might hear any day now.
I believe he actually gave a date. I think he said he thought he would find it by the 12th.
Wow. Oh, so any day now.
I know, and I'm truly hoping he does, because I'm ready to rewrite the last chapter.
I was wondering if there was part of you that kind of the romance of the mystery, or do you really genuinely hope it gets found, or does it belong in the ethereal mists of history?
I actually... No, not the ethereal mist. I actually want
bring that plane home.
What happened to her? Yeah. Bring that plane home.
Okay,
absolutely.
I love this. We will wait with bated breath. I wish I could be a fly on the wall when you find the news, if they do find her, because I imagine it will be an emotional moment for you. I've really just loved hearing your story, and I've loved hearing more about Amelia Earhart. Thank you so much for your time. Love talking to you.
So I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Isn't she wonderful? Candace Fleming is her name. The book we've referenced most clearly that's used as an education resource in the United States is Amelia Lost: The Life and Disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Robert Ballard, the man who found the Titanic, is out there right now. Keep your eyes and ears to the skies.
I got down without any trouble and taxied to the front door of a surprised farmer's cottage. After receiving a real Irish welcome, I took a Paramount plane to London and there received a real English welcome.